Welcome to Equity. I'm Katie Roof, joined by my colleague, Matthew Lindley.
Hello.
Crunchbase News Editor-in-Chief, Alex Wilhelm. And today, our special guest is Ted Smith, who's a co-founder and president at Union Square Advisors, which means he's an M&A banker.
Hello. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks
he's
for joining us.
He's not a venture capitalist. It's so nice.
Well, last week we didn't have a venture capitalist either, and I like venture capitalists, and we're going to be having a lot more of them on our show, but
wait,
it's good
on.
To have a good diversity of types of guests.
Do you really actually like venture capitalists? Because to me, they're kind of like that dry, sawdust, vanilla, lackluster.
Don't answer that.
All right. I like them as long as they give me scoops. There's a lot of smart venture capitalists, but let's talk about what we're going to talk about. Blue Apron. Big news, breaking news, right before we started recording this podcast,
like Blue Apron 30 minutes ago.
Blue Apron filed or revealed its S-1, its IPO filing, which means their IPO is very, very soon. And for those of you who don't know, Blue Apron is a food delivery startup, a meal delivery startup, where they give you all the ingredients and then you have to make it yourself.
And they also have that really big egg carton that generates a lot of trash.
Yes, but...
the one that made Jordan very mad at TechCrunch.com.
I feel like there's an inside joke that just went right by me like a pitch in baseball, but okay.
Have you ever used Blue Apron?
Twice, I think.
Okay, then you haven't
gotten the egg. A long time ago.
Anyways, so onwards.
So I think we were all a little surprised, or actually at least I was surprised and you were surprised, Matthew, but maybe I thought that they were going to be losing more money than they are. They also have better revenue than I thought they would. Alex says the number's handy. I think they had about almost 800 million in revenue last year, and their losses were just around 50-something billion.
Million.
I mean, 50-something million. I'm sorry. It's been a long week. 50-something million. So, I mean, relative to their revenue, it's not that bad for a consumer tech IPO.
Yeah, and also critically...
especially e-commerce.
Yeah, yeah. But really important to me is if you look at their quarterly results going back to the first quarter of 2015, they actually had two profitable quarters in there. And then they've increased their marketing spend and so forth since then. But they really had a period of profitability before retreating back into much more red ink. But I'm curious, what do we think about that? Do you think it was a conscious choice to go back to losing
money?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
In Silicon Valley, we don't like profitability.
Well, what we do like is the ability to prove we can be profitable. And once we've made that proof point, then we can go back and show that if we spend more into the opportunity, gain more revenue, gain more market share, eventually we can get back to that point, right? There are some companies where the question is, can you ever get to that level of profitability or a sustainable level of profitability? I think they proved it. And then they said, okay, let's go spend into the opportunity because it's a huge market.
And well, they've been spending a lot of marketing. If you look at the breakdown, they've dramatically increased their spend on marketing over the past year. And I think that they're spending to grow. And it looks like it's working for them. So I think investors aren't going to be so focused on the bottom line right now, considering that their top line is growing faster than their bottom line is relative to how much they're losing. Their top line's
growing. Their marketing spend also is inclusive of retention money. So whatever they spend to keep customers active and on their core platform or using their products. So, but to frame it, I mean, they were spending about 15% of revenue when they were profitable on, quote, marketing, which is a single line item in their S-1. And now it's 25%. So that's a pretty dramatic change in how they allocate revenue towards marketing. And I'm curious if it's mostly new customer accretion or it's current customer defense.
Well,
anti-churn.
If you look at a company like Blue Apron, right, like you're trying to amass like a recurring base of millions of customers, and you know, attracting those young millennials, like most of their user base is pretty young. Attracting those young millennials in New York and San Francisco is only going to take you so far, and then you have to actually get into like the real meaty audience out there, which is, you know, not necessarily in New York, but maybe it's like Houston or like a suburb outside of Detroit or something like that, right? And you don't target those guys with Facebook ads. You target them with like billboards and TV ads and things like that. And that's expensive, right? And the sort of ROI on that is not actually obvious until a little bit further down the line. So it kind of makes sense that if you're trying to diversify away from, you know, the typical like metro area, your marketing spend, you have to change your strategy a little bit, right?
I think that's true. Although I also think that there's an element of this company that could be similar to other models. Take an Angie's List, right? Where you got the model right in a city. Once you got through that particular city and made that profitable as a sort of a same store model, you moved on to the next city and the next city. You knew what it took to spend into the opportunity initially and then grow that to profitability. So you may absolutely be right that the mix of that spend in Houston may be different than it is in San Francisco versus New York. But I suspect they've got the right thing dialed in on a city-by-city basis as they roll things out, and they know how long it takes to get profitable. So you may look at it in the aggregate and say unprofitable, but in their core markets, as those expand, they're going to be very profitable and increasingly profitable as a whole.
One has to wonder if they have to spend a greater percentage of their money on marketing because they are having any sort of problems with customer retention. Obviously, their financials are doing better than what was previously expected. There had been some reports for a while that not just Blue Apron, but a lot of these different meal delivery startups had problems with customer retention. The people try it for a little bit. I don't know about you guys, but I tried Blue Apron for like a week, and I didn't have time to cook these meals because they often take like an hour to cook. So for me, it wasn't going to work out. And so, you know, some people go through a phase where they test out Blue Apron, but I actually know a lot of people who stopped using it. So I wonder how, if they have to keep growing their customer base because some of their existing customers are churning.
Well, with respect to that, like, you know, as you're, one of the sort of tried and true ways of doing that is like coupons, right? Like, give me like $10 off, give me $50 off. But I think a sort of reverse barometer to that is if you look at their order numbers are still increasing, right? So if I'm looking at this right from the S1, you know, they had 4.3 million orders in the fourth quarter this year. They had 3.7 million in the fourth quarter last year, and 2.9 million in the first quarter of 2016, right? So that's still going up. So even if your customer base is churning and you're adding new people, at the end of the day, your business is still accelerating, right? Or maybe not accelerating, but it's still growing, and people are spending more. You're getting new users fast enough that you can kind of ignore the churn, at least for the time being.
I think that's all very good, and I know that I'm the grumpy anti-losses guy.
I was going to say something bad is about to come.
Right,
so.
Right. And I'm going to preamble by saying much better than Snap. So at least at a minimum, crushing the LA
scene. For those of you who don't know how Alex feels about Snap, that's not that big of a compliment.
I think Snap is a very interesting business.
I'm not mad. I'm disappointed.
That is basically, that's literally my face whenever I read an S1. I'm like, come on, y'all. Anyway, so here's a number that stood out to me, and we can talk about if I'm too conservative here or not. But in all of 2016, the company lost $54.8 million, which is not that much money for their scale, growth rate, and for a full year. Just not that bad. That's a gap number. And then in Q1 of this year, they lost 52.2, which is nearly their entire calendar 16 loss inside of one quarter in 2017. And that to me is a pretty serious deterioration in at least short-term profitability. So do we care, or am I just being a grumpy person?
I think the answer is probably somewhere in between. I think you absolutely highlight something that people are going to focus on, which is why is this business so more unprofitable in that first quarter than they were for all of last year? However, if we see revenue growth accelerating from where we are now, people are going to say, I don't care as much as I probably would otherwise, right? I'm okay if this company needs to spend $100 million, $150 million in 2017 in order to drive massive revenue growth in a brand new category where they really are the category leader, arguably the category creator, but they've got to be able to also articulate on that IPO roadshow that, hey, look, we know what it means to be a profitable company. We've done that before, and here's how we get there from here.
So,
actually, they may be the U.S. category leader, but there's something called HelloFresh, which is really big in Europe and pioneered this. I don't know technically who invented this concept, but they were also very early in this game. There's also Plated, which is we've heard mixed things about how well they're doing, but they're also a formidable competitor to Blue Apron. And then at this point, there's also Sunbasket, which I haven't tried, but there's so many at TechCrunch, we're having trouble keeping track of all of these. But Blue Apron in the United States is really a brand name.
By the way, I think you
businesses.
Sorry to interrupt. I think you're going to see some segmentation of these providers. So there's another company called Nurture Life out of Chicago. They're looking at the kid segment. We're going to see that for senior citizens. We're going to see it. I mean, they're going to subdivide this category, and that's where we're actually going to see some really interesting metrics when you look at that user base in terms of a much more granular capability of reaching them, keeping them, serving them over time than just human beings who like to eat, which tends to be a fairly large portion
of the
population.
So like wildly artisanal ingredients for $300 a
Absolutely.
Week or something like that. So
absolutely.
Well, I mean, another thing, kind of getting back to Alex's point really fast, though, is that, you know, this company you know, it's been pretty well capitalized, right? So in 2015, they raised $135 million from Fidelity, and they burned, what, like $54 million in 2016, right? So if you're looking at that, like, just that sort of balance sheet, you kind of get to Q1 of 2017, you're like, oh, wow, like, we have a ton of cash sitting here, and we're planning on going public to raise money, so, like, let's, like, seriously, like, jack up our numbers and start spending while we have the opportunity, right?
I mean, they just borrowed another $25 million against their credit facility in April of this year, bringing their total down draft to $125 million out of a $175 million facility. So they're fueling this with debt.
Yeah, but at the same time, they can turn it off, right? That's what they've shown. So,
well, maybe. And then I pulled the HelloFresh financial results just to be a comparison here. And in Q1 of 2017, they had 205 million euro in revenue, COGS of only 87 million euro, a much better gross profit percentage, and a 34 million euro deficit. And in the quarter, first quarter of Q1, 2016, it was 141 million euro in revenue and only $32 million loss. So they've actually shown much better improving margins at HelloFresh, whereas Blueprint has fallen apart. So that's kind of a contrast point.
Yeah, but not growing as rapidly.
Are
we going to see some consolidation here? I'm asking this for the M&A lawyer. I mean, do you think there's so many? I mean, there's many, many that we're not even mentioning right now. Do you think some of them are going to tie up to be stronger?
Okay, first, in case anybody listens to the podcast for legal advice, I'm not a lawyer, so, but I'm an M&A banker. So I think I can still try to answer the question,
right.
Which is absolutely we're going to see consolidation in this space, right? You're going to, it goes without saying that you're going to see the next 10 of these are going to come out of the woodwork, as we were talking before, the segmentation of the user base that I mentioned. Eventually, you're going to find that one or two or three of the leading players, of whom the two that have already been mentioned with Blue Apron and Plated and HelloFresh, are likely to be acquirers, particularly once they become public companies. So this will follow the way most tech companies or tech categories, rather, eventually evolve, which is it will become an oligopoly over time. And the way that'll happen is these leading public players are going to be acquirers of the new upstarts.
For like a business like Blue Apron or HelloFresh, like how long do you think investors will be patient with acquisitions, things like that, before they're like, okay, like where are our dividends? Where's our stock buybacks? Like we need to start actually like getting value back from this.
I think the reality of investors in tech companies is they don't really want to see those dividends and buybacks. I know it's been de rigueur for a lot of lower growth tech companies over the course of the last decade plus. IBM's a great example of a company that has continued to increase dividends and buybacks while top line has continued to decline.
The greatest accounting firm of all time.
Absolutely. That being said, right, what their investors are telling them is we want you to innovate. We want you to use your cash balance not to just manage earnings per share, but to actually build products and services that are super interesting so that you can reinject growth into the business. So as long as these newly public firms are showcasing real growth and to the extent that their market allows for it, innovation, I don't think their investors are going to say, give us that money back. But they are going to say, spend it on things that drive growth and ultimately lead to really profitable businesses.
You know who's not profitable?
Who's not profitable?
Uber.
I would never have guessed.
So Uber, they voluntarily released their financials again this week. And since we like data and numbers, we're glad that they released more data. But they were losing a bit of money. That happens to be timed with their head of finance leading. And now they say they're looking for a public company CFO or a CFO with public company experience. So
did they ever find the parental supervision, or are they just kind of skipping that step and going straight for
the COO, right?
Yeah.
Like,
there's a report due this week that was commissioned by the board. I think it's actually getting delivered.
Eric Holder, yes.
From Eric, that's going to deliver to the board this week. Whatever elements they're going to make that public that will serve the PR machine that is part of the Uber empire will come out next week. But we'll find out whether it's window dressing or there's actually going to be some real adult supervision.
Yeah, supposedly that was Wednesday of this week, but it hasn't yet, to my knowledge, leaked to the public. But if anyone has any info on that, I'm katie@techcrunch.com. So there's been a lot of leaks with Uber's financials in the past, myself included. At one point, I got their financials in 2015. But lately, they've been voluntarily releasing it. They released this quarter, and then a few months ago, they released last year's financials. But I think they feel that this tells a positive story, even though they are losing money. I think they're trying to tell the message, send the message that their revenue is growing and that their losses are shrinking relative to their revenue growth.
And that's true. I mean, their revenue was $3.4 billion in the first quarter, presuming that's GAAP, which is up 18% sequentially. And they lost $708 million in the first quarter, a very, very adjusted number, super non-GAAP, which was down 28.5% from their Q4 also adjusted loss number. So, yeah, that's margin improvement, but there's a lot of nuance there. I mean, there's the Uber pool accounting issue, which they had to count the full fare as revenue before they take their actual cut and pay out the driver and so forth. So the numbers are wonky and a little screwy, but they are showing an increase in gross bookings, an increase in GAAP revenue, and a decrease in something kind of equivalent-ish to profit on a different planet. I don't know what I would actually call it. Profit minus other stuff, I think maybe.
Profit minus other expenses.
Still no China numbers, right?
The China numbers, but that's all non-continuing operations. So we're not comparing this quarter's result to a Q1 number for
last
year.
Well, so is Starbucks
year.
For Square.
Yeah, and how'd that go for them? I think we all know the answer. But I mean, are we at all surprised or impressed by Uber's disclosures here, or does this roughly match our expectations?
I think that they're disclosing this on purpose. I mean, there was obviously a lot of speculation about their financials. There's obviously been a lot of speculation about what's going on inside their company. I mean, there have been countless executive departures lately amid a lot of controversies that I can't even begin to list. But and so I think they're trying to send the message that they're still growing, that this hasn't hurt them, that they're doing better than what people are saying, that Uber's not dead. They're very much still gaining momentum. And I do think that despite what Travis loves to say, that he doesn't want to do an IPO, this is a pretty big hint that they're trying to gauge potential investor sentiment ahead of an eventual IPO. And I think the biggest clue of all is the fact that they're looking for a public company CFO, one with public company experience, because that's something that people do or companies do ahead of an IPO, usually about a year and a half before an IPO. But still, I think that this could be a late 2018 IPO.
So it's a job listing.
I think, look, every one of the releases that describes their financials, I agree, is a trial balloon sent up to try to determine what the investor sentiment is these days. And I think it's gone up and down, frankly, even over the course of the last year. I think the search for a public company CFO is actually a double-pronged approach. One is, absolutely, if we want to go public, we need somebody with that kind of experience. We have a complicated global business. We're going to need somebody who can help us understand and articulate that. The other thing that they're doing when they say that is they're trying to calm the nerves of their existing investors who've put billions of dollars of capital into this business and are really worried. Is somebody just lighting fire to that over at Uber headquarters? Or am I going to get a return on that investment? That goes back to the comment around adult supervision. If somebody's over there actually minding the store and thinking through how we spend our capital, then I can feel a little bit comfortable that I don't have to start to beat the drums that we should be doing something completely different at the company.
So if the numbers looked worse, let's say the loss was still going up on a sequential quarter basis, would that really increase pressure on Travis enough to potentially cause a change of the king?
I think that there is pressure there right now. I mean, I don't think he's about to leave, but I think that there's pressure on him right now. I think he's, I mean, obviously, you know, my condolences to Travis. This has been a terrible week for him. So I don't want to, you know, talk too much about some of the struggles that he's had. But, you know, it really doesn't look good to have this many executive departures at his company. It really doesn't look good to have all the problems with sexual harassment that they've had. There's just been an ongoing sea of negativity. And investors and board members, they don't just care about your financials. They care about the company culture as well, especially if it impacts, especially if it's causing a lot of good key people to leave all the time.
But I can I just amend that ever so slightly? It's not just that it looks bad, it's that it's awful. I mean, their talent exodus has now reached, I want to say double digits in executives this year alone. It's kind of staggering. I don't even have a good working list in my mind of how many people they've lost that are critical.
Is this Twitter?
Well, it's close to it, but it's worth a lot more.
No, but I mean,
I think it's more than Twitter, which is crazy.
Do we think this is a Twitter situation?
It can't be Twitter. It's still growing.
Hey.
Yeah, they're financials, not like Twitter. Executive departures like Twitter. But I mean, actually worse than Twitter. I mean, it just seems like the head of almost every division has left recently, and that's really not good for a pre-IPO company at all. In fact, even before all this happened, one thing that always struck me as unusual about Uber is for a pre-IPO company with a high valuation, there were just a lot of employee departures. I meet so many ex-Uber employees around town, and that's just not something I see very often with late-stage pre-IPO companies. People want to stay through the IPO. They want to stay. I mean, sometimes they're financially incentivized to do so, and it's just always seems strange to me.
Is it a cultural thing? Are they leaving because
absolutely.
Of... Okay, so they're saying effectively it's so toxic, yes. We're done.
I have heard that from some of the people. Some of the people left on better terms, although... It's been mixed, but it's definitely unusual to have that many people leave.
I think the personal economics point is a really good one, right? Which is people get into startups whenever they happen to join, or early stage pre-public companies, for a whole host of reasons. And one of them absolutely is, I think if I join now, I'm going to be a lot wealthier once this company goes public or it gets sold. For people in most cases to leave a significant amount of capital on the table when they walk out the door, there's got to be a fairly strong reason that they would do that. Now, part of it could be they found a bigger, better deal elsewhere where they think they're going to make more, better job, better compensation package. But the notion that you would walk away from a big slug of unvested stock knowing that there's this pressure, potential pressure for the company to go public, and knowing that you would be fairly close to beginning to realize some real personal liquidity, that's a hard thing for people to want to walk away from. And there's got to be a lot of rationale, a lot of deep-seated rationale for somebody to make what's for most people is a pretty difficult economic decision.
Can I ask you a really unfair question?
Sure.
Okay. So while we have you in the mics, we're all live. Going back to your point about impossible investor freakouts concerning the cash situation and expenses and losses, what do you do if all of a sudden you've sunk $1 billion into this company and you're freaking out? Like, what's your sound the alarm in a way that's quiet? Because you can't go public with your complaints. It'll harm market sentiment. What do you do behind the scenes if you're that investor who wants to change the ship at Uber now because you're terrified?
You find like-minded investors who are similarly freaked out, and you figure out what changes you need to make at the company as a club. Of investors, a group of investors. Maybe they sit on the board, maybe they don't, right? Because you've got a whole bunch of people who've put a lot of money in this, not all of whom are represented at the board level. But you find a group of like-minded folks who say, we need to affect change. We're coming to you as a group, a faction.
A consortium.
A consortium of concerned investors. And together, we think we're raising enough alarm bells that you should pay very close attention to.
Are there any good examples of a private cohort of investors in a company actually managing to force board level changes aside from Zenefits?
Well, no, I was actually saying, like, I mean, we can obviously we don't have the kind of like backroom dealings, so we have to sort of speculate. But like with a company like Zenefits, there was obviously a ton of change that needed to be done at the company. So what did they do? They basically have the valuation so they wouldn't get sued, right? And so, I mean, is this? I don't know if we're sort of reaching the point where like things are getting so bad at Uber that, you know, suddenly Travis or the executive teams could face some kind of like aggressive push from like literal activism from their private investors. Yeah. But maybe
what does activism look like for a company this big that's still private? I mean, I think we all have a good idea of what public activism looks like for a company of this scale. But in this case, it's much more interesting because it's much more cloak and dagger.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably not going on CNBC and complaining about Herbalife.
Please
right?
do so. That. Please. If you own Uber shares, get on Squawk Box tomorrow and call us ahead of
Join
time.
Join Alex.
No, get on Equity. Come on.
I mean, get on Equity. It's like Squawk Box, but it's not on television.
And it's all right, well, we have video too. But I think one thing that Uber has that works in its favor is the product. I mean, let's face it, the product is pretty great. I tried switching to Lyft for a few months, and there's a problem with Lyft where it like takes a longer route. They recommend a longer route for getting to my apartment just so they can drop me off on the right side of the street, but it costs me like 5 or 10 minutes out of my way each time. So I've like switched back to Uber because of that annoyance. And so I don't know, it just seems like there's little things like that that Uber gets right. And I think they have a pretty good product, and that's why users, even if they feel a little bit guilty using it sometimes because of all the negativity out there, I think a lot of users are still going to use it anyway.
You know what they're not good at?
Making money.
M&A.
Oh.
All right. And so, right. So we have, we wanted to talk a little, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about M&A here. Cause obviously, you know, what's happening and what hasn't been announced yet. And while we know you can't tell us specific deals, although you could maybe tell us secretly later, I wanted to find out which categories you're expecting within tech to see more consolidation this year, like what kind of buyers we're looking at, what kind of targets we're looking at. I just want to hear your general sense where sure. things are going.
Sure. So the good news is there's still a very robust M&A market out there today. And particularly for guys like me who participate in that, we're very happy to be in the middle of that flow. What's interesting to me is the dollar volume of the transactions that have happened so far this year are fairly significantly off from last year, somewhere between 30 and 40%. But the number of transactions that have been announced so far, pretty much on pace with last year. So we're seeing as many deals, and I think eventually this year we will outperform last year in terms of the number of transactions. It, unless we get a really big series of blockbuster deals, probably will be difficult for us to exceed last year's dollar volume. But I think what people should take away first and foremost is very robust M&A environment still in and around the tech space. The other thing people should take away is that continuing the trend over the last several years, this is not exclusively a game in acquisitions about large companies, strategic buyers buying smaller players. There is a whole new world that has emerged over the course of the last half a decade where private equity plays an enormous role in tech M&A. They have a tremendous amount of capital to spend on acquisitions. And as everybody I'm sure who listens to equity knows, not every company is right for private equity. Companies that lose a lot of money, companies that are small, companies that haven't yet proven their business model out tend to be the province of the venture capitalists that are the primary guests on this show. But by the same token, you've got those private equity players who are doing earlier and earlier deals. They believe they can buy into these platform companies earlier than they would have 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And so there are real forces in the market for technology M&A that we didn't see, you know, half a decade ago.
You're the third person this month to tell me that we're going to see more private equity backed M&A transactions related within tech, which is actually kind of unusual because, you know, kind of what you're saying, private equity I tend to associate with other industries. You know, they tend to look at some of the more veteran companies and turn them around. But it seems like they're dealing a lot more with tech these days, not just the growth equity rounds, but buyouts as well. And it I don't know, it just sounds like there's going to be more M&A that are sponsor backed.
So is that a function of just the sort of tech industry's problems kind of expanding beyond just tech? Like if you look at Blue Apron, like it's not just a tech company, right? It's like a whole chain of logistics and sourcing. And there's a lot of new tech, you know, tech, quote unquote, tech companies that aren't just pure technology anymore, right? Is that why all of a sudden like private equity, which may have some expertise in this area, kind of decides they want to step in and actually target these companies?
No, I think that there could be part of that. But I also think a big part of it is that private equity figured out over the course of the last 5 to 10 years that technology companies in general and software companies in particular actually are really good bets for the kinds of transactions that they ultimately do. Early on when private equity looked at technology broadly as an industry, they didn't think it was a very good bet because they couldn't figure out how they were going to back a company that sold ones and zeros for a living, right? What are the assets that we're going to lend against in a company like that? Well, it turns out that companies that have 80 to 90% gross margins, like software companies do, as opposed to 20 to 30% or 50% and much lower commensurate operating margins, those software companies are better bets because they more regularly will generate the kind of profitability that are needed to do leverage buyouts, which is what oftentimes you've got these private equity folks. That's the transaction structure that they're most familiar with. By the same token, you've also found some of these large private equity firms who are now doing minority investment. So the KKRs of the world, the Premieres of the world, whose primary job for decades has been to do these leverage buyouts, in many cases non-tech companies moving into tech, they're now making minority investments as large-scale growth style investments. So we were seeing a spread in the types of investment they're making in tech companies as well.
Who has the power right now, the buyer or the seller? I want to know how valuations are with M&A.
I'd say right now it's still a seller's market. The multiples being paid for most companies are on a traditional comparative basis are still through the roof. Nobody I know.
That was so polite.
Nobody that I know in the venture or private equity community thinks anything is cheap right now. But by the same token, you still got the power of the capital is still obviously on the buyer side. So they're able to dictate a lot of the terms. I think, but right now, I think we still have a bit of a seller's market.
So if you want to sell your company, now is the time. Well, thanks so much. Tune in next week.
All right, everyone. We want to say a special thanks to our producer, TechCrunch's own Christopher Gates, our executive producer, Henry Picavet. Thank you to Katie Roof. Thank you to Matthew Lindley. And thank you to you for leaving us that 5-star iTunes review. That's Equity. We'll see you all next Friday.
Kiss Aaron later.
Aaron's great. Like, I love Aaron.
Wub, 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 wub. Wub, 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 wub. Wub, 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 wub.
Aaron's great. Like, I love Aaron.
Hey.